The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. This week, we're going to look at drug policy in the United Kingdom and efforts within Parliament to make reforms, including decriminalization and the expansion of harm reduction. But first, the Commission on Narcotic Drugs held another set of intersessional meetings from October 22nd through 25th in Vienna, Austria. In essence, these meetings are in preparation for the 62nd session of the Commission on Narcotic Drugs, which will be held in March of 2019. The October intersessional meetings covered law enforcement and supply reduction-related measures, alternative development and crop control strategies, and cross-cutting issues including new psychoactive substances. A lot of the discussion around law enforcement was disappointingly limited. There were plenty of statistics on seizures, arrests, productions, etc. There was much hand-wringing about how law enforcement efforts are at best shoveling against the tide, with production on the increase, new psychoactive drugs on the increase, drug purity increasing, drug prices dropping. Basically, a laundry list of the failures of law enforcement strategies. Those lists of failures are then followed by assurances from several nations, such as Russia, China, and unfortunately these days the United States, that if we just keep doing the same things that have consistently failed for the past several decades, then magically things will come out differently. But I digress. For the past decade now, non-governmental organizations have been making inroads at the United Nations. We're inside the meetings of the Commission on Narcotic Drugs, and NGO representatives even get invited to officially address the Commission. On the afternoon of October 24th, the Commission heard from Gretchen Burns Bergman, director and co-founder of an organization called A New Path. A New Path is a U.S.-based nonprofit organization working to reduce the stigma associated with addiction through education and compassionate support. PATH, by the way, stands for Parents for Addiction Treatment and Healing. Here's Gretchen Burns Bergman.
The opioid overdose crisis is a global epidemic. In the United States today, one person dies every 10 minutes from an overdose. 72,000 people lost their lives to accidental overdose in the U.S. in 2017, which was up from 64,000 deaths in 2016. The number of first-time heroin users has increased dramatically, many switching from prescription pain medicines, and the sharpest increase of death is from fentanyl. There's nothing more tragic than young lives being lost unnecessarily before they have the chance to reach their full potential. The grief experienced by parents and family members is heightened by a sense of frustration and rage that this loss could have been prevented. Unfortunately, many still don't talk about overdose because of shame and stigma. I'm Gretchen Burns Bergman, executive director and co-founder of A New Path, Parents for Addiction Treatment and Healing, and lead organizer of our International Moms United to End the War on Drugs campaign, now in 33 states and 6 countries. We work to end the stigmatization and criminalization of people who use drugs and people who struggle with substance use disorders. I'm also the mother of 2 sons who have struggled for decades with heroin addiction. They are survivors of a punitive criminal justice system. My older son is a survivor of accidental overdose. I'm lucky that both of my sons found their way to long-term recovery, but they've lost far too many friends to overdose, and I know far too many mothers who have lost a beloved child. We must stop wasting resources by employing failed drug war tactics to address what's essentially a public health epidemic. PATH promotes therapeutic rather than punitive drug policies. Moms are suggesting a better way to save lives, and we propose 5 policies to potentially solve the opioid overdose crisis. First, the government must provide adequate funding to address the epidemic. To this day, despite numerous commissions to discuss the crisis, needed funds haven't been allocated. Second, we need to have a healthcare system of treatment on demand. The U.S. is behind other countries like Portugal in achieving this, despite the obvious need. Third, we promote and advise therapeutic services, not criminalization and mass incarceration. Fourth, Medication-assisted treatment has been proven to be effective in treating addictive illness, so these services should be provided in the community as well as behind bars. And fifth, community-based harm reduction services must be made widely available. These include syringe exchanges, safe consumption spaces, and most importantly, naloxone distribution. Since 2014, PATH has been conducting community-based parent-to-parent and peer-to-peer overdose prevention training and naloxone distribution in San Diego County under a standing order with a local physician. 371 overdoses have been reversed, and we've trained over 2,000 people through our program. Naloxone is a safe and effective medicine that quickly reverses an opioid overdose. It's the right and responsibility of everyone who takes opioids and their family members and friends to have naloxone readily available. Parents are often the first responder, and every moment counts in saving a precious life. With our Ask Mom How to Save a Life campaign, mothers across the nation are promoting greater awareness about our power to prevent overdose deaths with naloxone. They're training parents to administer it, encouraging physicians to prescribe it, and pharmacies to carry it. Many of the moms leading this campaign have children who struggle with substance use disorders and who were repeatedly incarcerated or who have died from preventable drug overdoses. Anyone who has a loved one who struggles with addictive illness or who has been prescribed narcotic pain medicine should have naloxone easily accessible. The most dangerous time for an accidental overdose is when a person is on a waiting list for treatment or when they are released from jail, prison, or rehab because of lowered tolerance. Too many people have had their lives cut short unnecessarily, and families have had to deal with unbearable pain. Having greater access to naloxone is a positive, proactive step towards ending the opioid overdose epidemic. Adopting strategies that help to reduce the harms associated with drug use and substance use disorders will save lives and heal families.
That was Gretchen Burns Bergman, director and co-founder of A New Path, Parents for Addiction Treatment and Healing. She was addressing the Commission on Narcotic Drugs intersessional meeting on October 24th. Once again, those CND meetings are only webcast live. They do not keep any video or audio archive. UNODC.org, follow the links to the Commission on Narcotic Drugs. You'll see what I mean. It's frustrating. This is the 21st century. Now, I don't have the travel budget to get to Vienna to be there in person. So instead, with the help of very strong coffee and a stable Wi-Fi connection, I stay up and record as much as I can, and I bring you the good bits on my show. We'll have more from the Commission on Narcotic Drugs intersessional meetings next week. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. Now to the UK. There was a debate on drug policy in the House of Commons on October 23rd. That debate was arranged by Ronnie Cowan, a member of Parliament from the Scottish National Party, representing the constituency of Inverclyde. It was a non-legislative policy debate. That is, it was a debate on the underlying policies with a view toward crafting legislation. It was not a debate on a particular piece of legislation. We're going to listen now to a portion of that debate. Here's the opening statement from Ronnie Cowan, MP.
The UK drug policy is not just a combination of the Misuse of Drugs Act 1971, the Psychoactive Substances Act 2016, and a host of schedules and classifications. It's a range of laws which we've developed over years that have been put in place by our guided perceived knowledge and our current attitude. We put them in place because we thought it was the right thing to do, and it's my belief that we got it wrong. Out with the drugs law, we have laws that regulate the production, distribution, marketing and consumption of alcohol. And alcohol is an interesting case because it's not included in the 1971 Misuse of Drugs Act. Alcohol remains socially acceptable. It's consumed openly at christenings, naming ceremonies, weddings, civil partnerships and even funerals. At hatches, matches and dispatches, society finds a place for alcohol. But it wasn't always this way. Prohibition and abstinence were once very strong movements. But in the 1920s, some states in the USA made alcohol illegal and something strange happened. It didn't stop people drinking alcohol. What it did was it delivered the production, distribution and consumers into the hands of criminals who recognised a money-spinning venture when they saw one. The production became more potent, the product became more potent, because that meant distributing smaller quantities while maintaining profit margins, and criminal gangs used extreme violence to protect their territory from rival gangs or gangsters. The levels of violence spiralled, and more people were criminalised for using alcohol. According to the academic and historian Michael Lerner, as the trade in illegal alcohol became more lucrative, the quality of alcohol on the black market declined. On average, around 1,000 Americans died every year during Prohibition because of the effects of drinking tainted liquor. When Prohibition ended, levels of crime dropped dramatically and people's health improved. They continued to drink alcohol, but the product was quality controlled and monitored, and nobody had to use violence to protect their market. Alcohol continues to this day to damage people's lives and ruins people's health, but it's legalised, regulated, and increasingly people can find education and support because they have no fear of being criminalised. Maybe in an ideal world, everybody would be so happy and content, so free of stress and anxiety, so confident and self-assured that there would be no requirement for alcohol or indeed any recreational drugs. But we are not there, and we never have been. Throughout history, for a variety of reasons, people have taken drugs. 100 years ago, you could buy cocaine, heroin or morphine in pharmacies and department stores. During the First World War, Harrods sold kits with syringes and tubes of cocaine and heroin for the boys on the front line. Queen Victoria recommended wine laced with cocaine, Van Mariani. Anthony Eden was prescribed Purple Hearts during and throughout the Suez Crisis. They lived under what was termed the British system. It was a light-touch approach to drug consumption, one of tolerance and treatment. Things were changing during the 1960s. In 1961, the UN Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs was passed. It was not popular in the UK, because you can see here that the British system was working. In 1961, that convention, driven by prejudice, became the only UN convention ever to use the word evil. Torture, apartheid and nuclear war do not warrant the term evil. According to the UN, genocide is referred to as an odious scourge or barbarous acts. The term evil is reserved for drugs. Drugs that have previously been available in many different guises and high street pharmacies. The stigmatising of users went up a gear. And in 1971, through the Misuse of Drugs Act, criminalisation became the name of the game. The results have been years of violence, tensions, organised crime and a monumental increase in addiction.
I congratulate the Honourable Member on this absolutely first-class speech he's making at the moment. Could he say, you know, roughly, what proportion of the prison population are now, the people in prison are there because of the drug trade? What are the costs to the criminal justice system? What's the total social cost of drugs? I hope he will cover these things in his speech.
On account.
I didn't know it was a quiz. We all know, every one of us, I've got a prison in my constituents, I know, talking to the governor 2 or 3 weeks ago, that the majority of people in that prison are there in some way, shape or form related to the consumption of drugs or the selling of drugs or the drug market and the violence around it. And we also know that the number of drugs within our prisons are more available, particularly synthetic drugs available in our prisons than there are available out in the streets. So the ONS, you're glad to hear, began collating consistent data on drug deaths in England and Wales from 1993, and figures show that an increase in drug misuse mortality rates amongst both men and women since 1996. UK opioid-related deaths rose between 2012 and 2015, increasing by 58% in England, 23% in Wales, 21% in Scotland and 47% in Northern Ireland. UK Focal Point on Drugs estimate the number of problem drug users is 300,000 in England, 60,000 in Scotland and 30,000 in Wales. Those statistics are the results of the current drugs policy. And behind those statistics are lives in ruins. I can fully understand why people exposed to the cruelty inflicted on their loved ones by the current drug policy would want to lash out for retribution. If somebody provided one of my loved ones with a pill at a music festival and that pill killed them, my initial reaction would be to hunt them down like a dog and have them strung up. I would be wrong. At the next festival, another person would be selling the same drugs to more people and another tragedy would unfold. The understanding of this is exemplified by the members of Anyone's Child. These are people who have been directly affected by the loss or damage caused to a close friend or family member, and yet they understand that vengeance wouldn't bring back their loved one or undo the damage done. They understand that unless we change our current drug policy and how we enforce it, more innocent people will die. It is their desire that their experience of loss does not fall on anyone else's family member or friend. And I would ask the Minister if she's prepared to sit down to meet and talk to members of Anyone's Child. Nothing.
Will the Honourable Member give way?
Certainly.
Graham Morris.
I'm grateful and I would like to congratulate the Honourable Member for Inverclyde on initiating the debate on making some really powerful points in his speech. He and I both attended the recent meeting of the Drugs, Alcohol and Justice All-Party Parliamentary Group on Drugs-Related Deaths, and we heard Rudy Forston QC explain how policies could be readily implemented to reduce drug-related deaths, drug and alcohol-related deaths. And would he agree with me at this point that it would be a good thing for ministers to meet with Rudy Forston QC and see what policies could be applied instantly that would make a big difference?
Yeah.
Thank you very much. It's always really good for me when I hear people like Rudy Forston, a QC, a person who's lived his life through the law, is looking at the current situation and think we have to change it. It backs up everything I believe, but he comes from a much more qualified background in that term than I do. And I wonder if the government are actually engaging with people of his calibre. Last week in Canada, joined 9 states of the USA and Washington DC to legalise recreational cannabis. They've taken a different approach in various states regarding the age limits. Some Canadian provinces will allow people to grow their own, limiting them to 4 plants. Other provinces do not allow home growing. We should be looking to those parts of the world to gather evidence and decide if their approach is beneficial and if we should follow suit. Canada has the same problems we have, but like Portugal and Uruguay and others, they've taken a different approach to providing a solution. And it's not drugs for everybody, it's regulate the marketplace, take away controls from the criminals. In the UK, parents of children that fear their child could be dabbling in drugs or even developing a habit are extremely reluctant to engage with support groups that could divert that child from the path they're on. And the parents are reluctant because they don't want to place their child on the police radar. They fear they could be arrested, get a criminal record, or even be sent to prison. Early intervention can be the key to avoiding drug-related harm, and we should not be putting obstacles in the way of those that could be affected. We must encourage users to engage without fear of prosecution and free up valuable police time and resources to fight crime. Can the Minister tell me if the UK government has engaged with other countries to access their research, which could assist us in becoming better informed and help us to take an evidence-based approach to legislation? And we need to listen to those affected that can see a change for need for change, but not in a position to affect it. Prior to this debate, the Westminster Digital Engagement Team put out an appeal on social media advertising this debate and asked the people of this country, what do you think? Their responses, which they've furnished me with, are they're engaged with nearly 20,000 people, and the majority of people came back saying, legalise cannabis. Some called for drugs to be regulated and taxed. A few commentators said they'd lost loved ones as a result of the current policy, and some commentators called for a drug addiction to be seen as a health issue rather than a criminal one. Lots of commentators called for the UK to take the same approach as Portugal. That's the people of this country talking. The problematic users, the kids in the estates, recruited the county lines, the medical professionals, the support workers and the law enforcers should be listened to. Peter Blexley was a young cop during the Brixton riots. He went on to become one of the Met's most celebrated undercover agents. He was a founding member of SO10, Scotland Yard's dedicated covert policing unit. He said, I look back now and I think, well, are there less drugs and guns in the streets because of what I and my colleagues did? And of course the answer is an emphatic no. We could wallpaper my bedroom with commendation certificates. They sit in the loft gathering dust. What a waste of time. Certainly.
Mary Lyndon.
Congratulate him on this debate. And does he agree that the fact that the UK government spent an estimated £1.6 billion on drug law enforcement in 2014-15, and then drug treatment's been cut by 14% in the last couple of years? And does he agree, really, that that's a false economy, especially as Public Health England estimates that for every pound spent in drug treatment, there's a £4 social return?
I absolutely agree. If that money on the criminal justice system was suspended, we can see the results. I'd back off and say, well, it's working, but it clearly isn't. And take that figure further down the line, every £1 spent at early intervention saves £7 in the criminal justice system further down the line. So even if I've said to people before, if you don't give a damn about these people, it makes good financial sense anyway to step in and get early intervention. Peter's not alone. From a host of personal testimonies gathered by UK Leap Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, I'm going to offer just four more from these experts. In Afghanistan, I fought on one front line of the so-called war on drugs. And in Hackney, I lived side by side with the other, and it's obviously failing at either end. If real generals pursued an active war, like generations of politicians have pursued this farce, they'd be court-martialed and sent to prison. That's from Patrick Hennessy, British Army officer, Grenadier Guards serving in Afghanistan. Far from making communities safer, current drug laws have the unintended consequence of placing barriers between the police and often vulnerable individuals. Paul Whitehouse, Chief Constable. The drug problem will continue and escalate if governments fail to recognise that the only way forward is to move towards nuanced regulatory models, thus removing the profit from criminals and the motivation for their involvement. James Seabee, former Detective Superintendent, International and Organised Crime Branch, New Scotland Yard. The single greatest crime reduction measure the world could take would be to regulate the supply of cannabis, cocaine and heroin. Francis Wilkinson, Chief Constable. Neil Woods, 14 years an undercover drugs cop, would say exactly the same things. Ron Hogg and Arfon Jones, both police and crime commissioners, say that drugs must be a health issue, not a criminal justice one. Every time we lock up a criminal gang and announce to the media that we've seized a large quantity of drugs with a street value of so many millions, what they don't say is that supply has been disrupted for an hour or so, before another gang will step into their shoes and maintain the distribution. Often these takeovers involve a spate of violence, and they are always maintained by violence and the threat of violence. The fact is that after 30 years of locking people up, a bag of cocaine will cost £10 in 1980, will cost you £10 today for the same weight. But because cocaine is so plentiful, it is purer today in the UK than it has ever been. The damage being inflicted on people and communities shall continue to increase if all we do is crack down on the criminal fraternity and those ensnared in problematic drug use. We can lock people up for longer. It does not improve the situation one iota. In fact, it makes it worse. Will the Minister meet and listen to members of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition? In July 2017, the UK government published its drug strategy, and they announced they were going to appoint a recovery champion. A recovery champion whose role was defined as someone who will be responsible for driving and supporting collaboration between local authorities, public employment services, housing providers and criminal justice partners, ensuring that these critical public services are able to contribute fully towards securing effective outcomes for individuals suffering drug dependence. 15 months later, there is still nobody in the role, so nobody is coordinating those aspects of the support and the recovery programme. I find myself wondering if there is a UK government harm reduction recovery programme. Minister, when will you appoint a recovery champion? As legislators, we do have a choice. We can change the law, and in doing so, we can address the harm that drugs do. Before that, we have to take a constructive approach to our drugs policy. We need to accept the fact that 90% of people who use recreational drugs do not live chaotic lives. We must acknowledge that of the 10% of users that become problematic users, the majority have suffered physical, psychological or sexual abuse. We must acknowledge that problematic use is higher in areas of social deprivation. We must accept the responsibility of trying to find solutions and acknowledge our failures. We need to help people with problematic drug use with harm reduction treatment and wraparound support. Criminalising users doesn't deal with the underlying issues that lead to drug use. It only makes things worse. We should have a network of safe drug consumption rooms throughout the UK. They have proved to be a success in Switzerland, Canada, Spain, and a growing number of other countries. We must be prepared to learn from other countries' experiences. The emergency services should carry naloxone and be trained in its use. Will the Minister reconsider the legalisation of safe drug consumption rooms and ensure naloxone is provided for members of the emergency services? And most importantly, the UK drug policy should be a health issue, not a criminal justice one. Or we can continue to criminalise users, drive them into the hands of unscrupulous dealers while ignoring the atmosphere of fear that they live in. And all we do is marginalise them, stigmatise them and ostracise them. Briefly.
Mr. Blunt.
Subject of drug consumption rooms. But did he note, after his last debate on drug consumption rooms, that the International Narcotics Control Board then produced a report on it, effectively endorsing drug consumption rooms, and that coming from the body that is responsible for the international enforcement of the relevant drugs conventions, which I know he and I both think are outdated and, frankly, dangerous in their in what they actually deliver in terms of global consequences around drugs policy. But if even they are in that place, hopefully our government will be able to take some notice.
Tony Cowan.
I did indeed. I noticed a couple of things after that last debate. We had that debate in this House, and the Minister of that debate denied the fact that Canada had kept their drug consumption rooms open because they were effective. She made the statement that the Supreme Court had ordered them to stay open. On the back of that, the Canadian Drug Policy Coalition, the Canadian HIV and AIDS Legal Network, the International Centre for Science and Drug Policy wrote to myself and the Minister a five-page letter detailing how the DCRs worked effectively in Canada and why they'd kept them open. Described her statement as factually or legally incorrect. So, in closing, we have lost the war on drugs. Our own drugs policy saw to that. We need to change our mindset, and we need to ensure we're in a position to win the peace. And finally, Mrs. Moon, can I say to everybody that when we see a problematic drug user, we are watching a person drowning. Please throw them a life belt. Do not push their heads further under the water.
That was Ronnie Cowan, Member of Parliament from the Scottish National Party, representing the constituency of Inverclyde, opening a House of Commons debate on drug policy on October 23rd. Well, for now, that's it. I want to thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network, on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. Drug Truth Network programs are available by podcast. The URLs to subscribe are on the network homepage at drugtruth.net. The Drug Truth Network has a Facebook page. Please give it a like. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.